Shit. Just do 40 minutes of this. Shit.
Scuttery shite.
Yeah. Oh. Now, Key, that's too far. All right. Hey, you, and welcome. My name is Mike, and in this old potty episode, I am once again joined, as I always am, almost always, pretty much always, last while anyway, joined by Keith.
Hey,
it is. There you go. You heard him talking about poop, and now you're hearing him say hello. And in this old episode, we get a doozy. This is actually a pretty good one. Keith, you did all the heavy lift on this one. Keith was the researcher for this whole episode. Also, by the way, I also feel like I want to give a shout out to Benj, who's a researcher for the Last Chapter podcast. He's researched a lot of the episodes.
Yep.
I would say most in the last like 6 months.
Yep.
He's great. He does a very great job.
He does.
We thank him. And today we're thanking Keith for the story of the jetpack murder. This story is fucking insane.
It's all over the place. It's got everything. It has like jetpacks, murder, kidnapping, drugs.
Beating the shit out of somebody with a hammer.
It's fantastic.
This story is pretty wild. I would say it's amazing there hasn't been a movie about it, but there actually has. I've never seen it. It stars Paul Giamatti, and it stars that guy from It's Always Sunny.
Does it?
The priest guy. The cricket. Leprechaun, cricket, whatever the fuck. Yeah, that guy.
No way.
Yeah, he's in it.
There you go. I did not know that.
By the way, you know what? Before we get, how's the audience? How are you guys doing today? Great. That's great. I hope you answered. Or bad. I don't know.
Mike hears you barking.
I do. I hear you barking, big dog. Keith, how are you?
Good. Not bad. Mary. Little under the weather. I'm a bit all over the place. Like, I'm having a very uncoordinated day. I think so. I was like, my head's stuffed and it's thrown off my balance. Because I'm uncoordinated today, I'm like dropping stuff all the time. And then just as I was trying to rush in to leave the house, I dropped my keys and I got up. And then I'm like, do you know when your pocket gets caught in like the door? Do you ever happen to you?
Nothing. No. Oh, boy. Don't get me started on your pocket in the door tricky.
Oh, man.
That grinds my ear.
I like taking it as like a personal slight.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Angle the door. But,
I just go over and beat the shit out of the door.
And it always, it never happens regularly when I'm like in a happy
go. Do you ever do that when like something gets caught or you get pissed off? Like, you trip up on something and you go and you punch it or hit it.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's like, ow, my arm. Yeah. And now I'm doubly as pissed off.
You win this round, door.
Yeah.
I'll get you next time.
All right, so shall we jump in?
Yeah, let's do it.
We're just flying.
Rocket
belts, actually, is the correct terminology. Not jetpack, it's rocket belts.
They are different. Jetpacks and rocket belts are different.
Are they?
Yeah, a jetpack uses like jet. Like you use like a turbine.
Yeah.
Where a rocket belt is more of it's like a chemical reaction that he uses to... I don't know what chemicals
are. So probably most things are actual rocket belts. Not because when I think of a jetpack, I think of like chemicals causing fire, causing a reaction.
Yeah.
Rather than like, oh, okay, well, hey, listen, what do I know? But that sounds right to me. So, all right. It was January 1995 on a sunny Sunday in Texas when test pilot Bill Suter was gearing up for some action. Decked out in just a white helmet and jump seat. Oh, and of course, a 120-pound jetpack strapped to his back. He was ready to take off. It took a dedicated effort, involving 3 men over the course of 5 years, and an investment totaling several $100,000 to reach this pivotal moment. The pilot signaled he was good to go with a good old thumbs up, and with a twist of the throttle, a white cloud of steam erupted from the exhausts. Propelled by 300 pounds of thrust, Bill Suter shot up rapidly, reaching an altitude of 30 feet. For a duration of 28 seconds, Suter executed a graceful flight over Texas's Houston Ship Channel. Unfortunately, due to limited fuel, the flight needed to be brief. So Suter began his descent, executing a delicate landing back on solid ground. It had worked. The jetpack was a success, but things would soon go very, very wrong. Of the 3 men that built this jetpack, Brad Barker, Larry Stanley, and Joe Wright, 1 would end up dead, 1 went to prison for kidnapping, and the 3rd man has a secret. He's the only one who knows where this jetpack is today. Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun.
Now, the idea of flying solo isn't exactly groundbreaking. Humans have been obsessed by flight since the dawn of recorded history. We see it in Greek mythology with the whole Icarus tale. It didn't go so well for him. Even Leonardo da Vinci threw his hat into the ring, doodling ideas for a single-person flying contraption. Humans have always had this dream of cruising the skies, free as a bird. The concept of a jetpack was first thought up by a Russian named Alexander Andreev back in 1919. Basically, it was just a rocket motor stuffed into a backpack. But it wasn't until the late 1920s when jetpacks first really caught the public's attention, thanks to a comic strip with Buck Rogers and his sidekick gal pal Wilma. But to set the record straight, back in the day, they were known as rocket belts, not jetpacks.
Yeah, there's a couple of stories floating around the internet that claim it was the Nazis who first properly experimented with the rocket belts. So the secret Nazi project, codenamed Heimelstürmer, or Skystormer, was destined to allow Nazi combat engineers and infantry to cross rivers, minefields, and other obstacles with ease. Apparently, by the war's end, only one prototype had made it through. What a bummer. Unfortunately, there also aren't any pictures floating around for the public's eye either. However, after the war wrapped up, Germany conveniently passed along the designs and the lone prototype to the USA.
Good old getting the old Operation Paperclip at it again.
That's it. Look, I don't know how true this is, but all I'm going to say, if Nazis did in fact have jetpacks, they sure as shit would have appeared in the Indiana Jones films.
Yeah, the shitter Indiana Jones films, like the newer ones, I think, though. It seems like a very Nazi thing to invent a jetpack.
It does, doesn't it?
Is that like they ever invented all sorts of weird shit that they were using to just murder more people with?
Yeah, they always had these like side projects.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is fucking up. It was a jetpack.
So what we do know for a fact is that Wendell Moore and his team at Bell Aerosystems in New York were the first to engineer what we would recognize today as a jetpack. After 3 years of rig testing, the US Army gave $25,000 to Bell Aerosystems to build an operational prototype, and in April 1961, the Bell Rocket Belt had its first free flight. Interestingly, a couple years later, in 1964, Wendell Moore's neighbor's son joined Bell Aerosystems as a test pilot. His name was Bill Suter, who we met at the beginning of the story. He went on to fly over 1,200 flights without serious injury. There was some injury, just not serious injury.
Yeah.
Hey, he's flying a rocket, like.
Yeah, exactly.
So unfortunately, military audiences, they were underwhelmed by the weight of the system, the deafening 130 decibel noise it made, and the extremely short 21-second flight.
How can we use it to kill people? That's the most important
thing.
That's
it. Yeah, 21 seconds is okay. It's not bad. You know, it's not the length of time. It's
maybe you could deafen them. It's 130 decibels. You could deafen them to death.
There you go. Yeah.
Kill them with that.
So unsurprisingly, the US Department of Defense did not continue funding the rocket belt. However, despite the setback, in 1965, Moore and the Bell team managed to secure a new research contract. This time around, they set their sights on using a jet engine to stretch out the flight duration. Impressively, they were able to vastly improve the flight to 5 minutes. However, it was very complex to maintain, it was so heavy that there was risk of spinal injuries, no good, and it was difficult to learn to fly. So the US Army once again lost interest in the jetpack project, and so it ended. On the bright side, the jet engine they designed was later used on the Tomahawk missile and most other US missile systems since the 1980s. So the jet belt program was actually indirectly very profitable for those companies involved. So yeah, all in all, it worked out very well for everyone who was not on the receiving end of a missile.
Yeah. But hey, if you're launching them, this is great.
That's it from the other end. It's brilliant.
Yeah, hey.
So despite its military flop, the rocket belt, it was just hitting its stride in popular culture. Moore and the Bell team, they pivoted the business by teaming up with a promoter with the hopes of generating money for entertainment bookings. The rocket belt was booked to appear at a number of events, such as Disney's Tomorrowland futuristic attraction, where it stole the show. However, it most notably appeared in James Bond Thunderball in 1965. Although the close-ups showing Sean Connery flying the device, they were clearly in front of a green screen, the shots of the rocket belt flying from the roof of the chateau to the ground, they were all real and piloted by, once again, Bill Suter. Things seemed to be on the up for the rocket belt, pun intended, when the whole Bell project came to a stop after Wendell Moore died of a sudden heart attack on the 29th of May 1969.
It was really his pet project, Wendell Moore's pet project, and then when he died, they were like, fuck, don't care anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
However, the story of the rocket belt was far from over. Nelson Tyler, an engineer and aerial photographer, got inspired about building rocket belts after catching a glimpse of the Disney's Tomorrowland demo. He saw the exact thing Keith was talking about, and he was like, I'm going to make myself one of them. After all, the Bell project stopped when Wendell Moore died, so nobody was making rocket belts, so Nelson decided,
I'll do it.
I'll do it myself. So in a real engineering marvel, he put together his own rocket belt, built from scraps in a garage or whatever the fuck that guy, that line from Marvel is, the Iron Man thing, spending around $15,000 of his own money on the project. Once he got the thing to actually fly, he brought in two test pilots, stuntman Kenny Gibson, and of course, the one, the only, Bill Suter. Flying Willie, I call him. He seems to be like your go-to jetpack guy. He flew the jetpacks for Bell Aerosystems or whatever, and now he's flying it for Nelson Tyler.
He is the Rocket Man.
The Rocket Man, he is indeed. Suter actually flew Nelson Tyler's rocket belt at the opening ceremony of the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. After the incredibly successful flight, Nelson Tyler was given a golden opportunity to make a large sum of money and sold the rocket belt to a theme park in Stockholm, Sweden. As for Suter, he decided to retire from flying rockets, or at least for the time being. Stuntman Kenny Gibson, however, went on to be employed by that theme park in Sweden, flying the rocket belt for various demos. But when he headed back to the US for a stunt contract, the park wasn't interested in a pilotless rocket belt anymore. No problemo. Somehow, Gibson managed to procure it and embarked on his own journey as the world's only rocket man now that Bill Suter had retired. So it's kind of amazing, like, that nobody else managed to... Like, it seems like it's very so specific, like...
A fair deal of training, I guess, to fly it.
And yeah.
I don't think anyone really wanted to take the risk. Like, yeah. he was a stuntman. He's like, yeah.
Well, it's also mad that, like, the aerospace company had to, like, put loads of money into it. And then Nelson Tyler was able to invent it in his, like, garage.
I know, yeah.
Perfectly. It probably cost a lot less. And we will go on to see how other people try and do it and end up costing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
That's it,
Nelson Tyler guy, he kind of comes and goes in the story pretty quickly, but he seems like he was like an Iron Man type
genius he was awesome.
Guy.
Yeah.
So now our new pilot, Kenny Gibson. He needed help repairing, maintaining, and manufacturing his own fuel for the rocket belt. So Kenny, he turned to a couple of friends to help with these tasks, namely Brad Barker and Larry Stanley. Brad Barker was an insurance salesman, but he was technically proficient and quickly learned how the rocket belt was prepared and operated. Larry Stanley was the money man, bringing in some serious wealth. This allowed him to dive into various entrepreneurial ventures and pursue his other interests, like computers, aeronautics, and, well, now, rocket belts. But this trio of Kenny, Brad, and Larry, far from the dream team. Due to Brad Barker's explosive temper and a bunch of financial woes, the three men would eventually go their own separate ways. Kenny Gibson, he got the short end of the stick after a bad investment that left him several thousand dollars in the hole, thanks to Larry Stanley, so they too had a falling out. The relationships between these characters is just like, everybody just kind of like fucks each other over constantly. And we haven't even really started.
I know, it's wild. And like, it always seems to be, when they're all falling out, it's always Barker that's at the center of it.
Yeah, he seems like a real piece of shit.
He's a real instigator as well.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you know how the story ends, it's just like, fuck Brad Barker.
Yeah, I know.
He's kind of like the only one who gets away out of all of this, like, scot-free.
Yeah, he done very well out.
So things between Brad Barker and Larry Stanley weren't any better when Brad Barker's most prized possession, his small single engine plane, went missing after he loaned it to his friend, let's say business associate, Larry Stanley. See, according to Barker, realizing it was gone, he reached out to the authorities and ended up talking to an FBI agent who claimed Larry Stanley was a known drug trafficker and smuggler under investigation. Now, it is worth noting we're just going by Barker's account here. There's no official record of this.
Yeah, he's made some wild claims.
He's a pure bullshitter, it seems like. Yeah. So eventually, Barker's plane did turn up in a hangar in Seattle, Washington. According to Barker, however, Stanley had added a long-range fuel tank to the plane, and which does sound like, Brad Barker suggested that this modification was meant for drug trafficking trips to South America. Kind of reminds me of that movie, what's the Tom Cruise movie?
Oh, yeah.
That's a good-ass movie.
American
Pilot or something like that.
God, what is that called?
I can't remember. It's a good movie anyway.
It is a good movie.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
But Brad Barker's real problem wasn't the modification. His real problem was the alteration itself, because that left an outstanding bill of $30,000 tied to the plane, which Larry Stanley, even though he was quite wealthy, he never paid the bill. Brad Barker, he had to sell the plane, leaving him with nothing. He figured Stanley owed him for it, but Stanley didn't see it that way, so the pair had a falling out. It would be a couple of years before they crossed paths again. However, even with Larry Stanley off the team, Kenny Gibson landed a lucrative contract to fly the Rocket Belt during Michael Jackson's Bad tour. After each show, Kenny Gibson would switch places with Michael Jackson, shooting into the air to make it look like the pop star was zooming off the stage, and Gibson pulled in $25,000 plus expenses for each flight, raking in almost $1 million for the entire Jackson tour. Which is a nice chunk of cha-ching to just fly in a jetpack once a night. Rocks it once a night.
Yeah. You can. Did you have a look at that on YouTube?
I haven't actually
seen
it.
It's actually cool. Yeah. You can. So the one with the Olympics where Bill Suter flew with the Olympics, that's on YouTube as well. And this one with the Bad Tour where Gibson flew it, that's on YouTube. It's really cool.
I actually want to see that.
It's kind of, yeah, at the end, he's finishing off his routine, his whole dance. And then you can clearly see where they switch. He just goes into like this box. For no reason. And then he comes out with a jetpack and then just like literally takes off and zooms off around the stage off the back.
Okay, I'm playing it now. So Kenny Gibson is now putting on the jetpack, which it is quite big.
It is, yeah, substantial. Like, but before I looked into the story, I could have sworn that was, it's all done on a string.
Okay, let's see what happens now. This is like, this looks stupid as all fuck. Like, it doesn't look cool.
$25,000, stupid.
Kenny Gibson's there, he's pointing a finger up at the crowd who are all waving back at him.
Thinking it's Michael Jackson.
Now he's flying. And yes, it's flying. There's no like exhaust out of it or anything. Yeah. It does look like he's just being held up with strings.
It does, yeah.
It looks kind of weird.
Very underwhelming.
Underwhelming, but yeah. Hey, for $25,000 a night, that's easy money.
That's the heart of this whole story.
Yeah.
Once you've the Rocket Belt built, it's easy money.
It's easy money. That's why everybody was fighting for the Rocket Belt. Very easy to make money out of it. So now, with Kenny Gibson having control of the Rocket Belt and taking on all the flying risks, as we just watched that old video, Barker didn't see a lot of that money coming his way. Kenny Gibson was the only one making any money out of this. So as tensions escalated in their relationship, it resulted in the two eventually going their separate ways. This story, it's kind of like The Lord of the Rings, only switch one ring for jetpack, and everybody's fighting for it.
I was thinking that, like, the whole time I was reading this, it really is like the jetpack's the one ring.
Yeah.
It makes everyone go insane.
Yeah, it's like a game of musical chairs, musical rocket belts.
Yeah.
Because you have a lot of characters coming and going in the story, all vying for the jetpack.
Yeah.
And the copious amounts of money that the gimmick brought in.
Yeah.
And eventually, it would lead to murder.
Murderously.
Murder. Oh, it would end this story, guys. It's going to end murderously. It was at this point, in the early 1990s, when Brad Barker got the idea to build my own rocket belt and reap in all the rewards. His goal was straightforward. Build the belts, go out, make a lot of money.
That's it, yeah, literally, yeah. What a business plan.
Hey, it works every time. But of course, he needed some backup for his venture. So he reached out to a friend of his named Joe Wright, a successful businessman running a shop called Car Audio Plus, specializing in selling and fitting car stereos, auto alarms, car phones, all these early 90s shit you needed for your car that were all add-ons. Now, Joe Wright also had useful contacts with various technicians and engineers, including some at NASA, which would no doubt come in handy during the build. See, Brad Barker was the visionary, and Joe Wright provided free space, equipment, and resources. But they still needed someone to fund their quest for flight and for riches. So, in 1991, Brad Barker got in touch with his former associate, oil man Larry Stanley. Yeah, so they kind of, it had been around 4 years since they last spoke after Stanley's joyride in Brad Barker's plane. And it took a good bit of convincing, but the pair were prepared to let bygones be bygones. Barker was willing to let go of the $30,000 bill that he believed Larry Stanley owed him for the plane fuel tank in exchange for Stanley's significant financial backing on the Rocket Belts. After all, it seemed like an opportunity to recover some of his money. What could possibly go wrong? So with that, the American Rocket Belt Corporation was founded in March of 1992, with Brad Barker and Larry Stanley going into the project as 50-50 equal partners. They were confident they could improve on the old Bell and Tyler Rocket Belt designs, the first two rocket belts that had been built. And so they set out to build what they called, and you gotta love this, the Rocket Belt 2000, otherwise known as the Orbee 2000. I love that. It's like, what are we gonna call it? 2000. It's like such a stupid, like, 90s, 80s, 90s idea. It's the coolest thing ever.
It's so futuristic.
The year 2000. Can you believe such a thing?
Yeah. Spoiler alert, it sucks.
So this was a huge undertaking for two amateur rocket belt builders who didn't have the same technical knowledge or engineering capabilities of the previous rocket belt builders who had come before them. One was an entire aerospace systems company, and the second was Nelson Tyler, who seems like he was a genius.
As I said, he was basically Iron Man.
So Brad Barker and Larry Stanley were nowhere near as competent as the previous people, but they were determined. Or they were just very greedy and saw dollar signs in their eyes and would do anything to make it a reality. So Larry Stanley began drafting technical blueprints for the rocket belt, to which Barker would then bring those drawings to machine shops to manufacture the necessary parts. Joe Wright, who they were renting, you know, the space from, was just as enthusiastic about the project and offered Barker and Stanley an office and workshop space at his Car Audio Plus store. They're building a fucking jetpack rocket belt in a place that's selling car radios.
I know. Imagine working there at the time. This is like you're just trying to come in, trying to do your job, and it's like a corner of the office is sectioned off. Like, don't go over there.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing over there? They're building rockets.
Rockets. So stupid. So for Joe Wright's role in this partnership, he was given 5% ownership and would also be paid $500 plus expenses for each month of occupancy. Barker and Stanley would eventually need some outside help and did hire some mechanics to help them with the engineering technicalities of piecing the device together. Finally, in October 1994, after more than 2.5 years of hard work and over $190,000, which is a ludicrous amount of money, the Orbee 2000, done, my friends. Yeah, remember when the original inventor of the rocket belt did it, Nelson Tyler? It cost him $15,000.
Yeah.
Inflation is a bitch.
At least a little more than inflation.
Yeah, inflation and idiots are very expensive. The next step was the testing stage. They knew it worked, but would it fly? Both men were eager to fly the rocket belt themselves. Only, once they knew how it worked, of course. To test fly the unproven device, they knew they needed a professional to test and train them, and there was only one man suited for the job.
Nice.
Bill Suter, the original Rocket Man.
He's back.
The return.
Now, at this stage, Suter, he hadn't flown a rocket belt for over 10 years. And it did, again, take some persisting, but his curiosity, it really got the better of him, and he agreed to test pilot their rocket belt. However, before Suter made the journey to Texas and strapped on the white helmet and jumpsuit, there was an incident which delayed the test flight.
Dun, dun, dun.
So it started with Barker and Stanley when they got into a heated argument over an extremely important issue concerning the rocket belt. Which one of them would get to fly the device once it had been successfully tested?
Hey, the pilots, they get all the chicks. So, of course, they're going to fight over who can be the pilot of the device.
That's it. It was so childish.
This whole story is so stupid. It's very funny.
It is, yeah. So, one afternoon in October 1994, the two men got into such a fiery dispute over who would get to fly the machine that they began to shout at each other across the office, throwing insults at each other like, "You're not flying my belt, lard ass." Real cutting to the core.
Yeah. Don't call me fat.
Well, it's a good point. You know, if you're packing pounds.
That's true. You know? It requires more propulsion.
That's it.
Yeah.
He was looking at it from an engineering standpoint.
Yeah, you need the small, skinny people to be the pilot.
So suddenly, according to Stanley, Barker snapped and grabbed Joe Wright's 9mm semi-automatic pistol from the desk and shoved it into Stanley's face, screaming, "Motherfucker, I ought to kill you right now." Stanley had seen Barker fly off the handle into fits of rage before, but nothing would leave him fearing for his life like this did. Luckily for Stanley, Barker, he quickly came to his senses before he did anything stupid, and he lowered a gun. Barker, he did apologise, saying that he didn't know what came over him, but you know, the damage had been done to whatever was left of their professional relationship at this point. A couple of days later, Stanley was talking to Joe Wright over the phone in the office, warning him about Barker and his unpredictable mood swings. He'd also said that he'd suspected that Barker was stealing money from the company and told him, "Barker's gonna fuck you the same way he fucked me." Unknowingly to Stanley, Barker, he'd been listening to that conversation.
I love this part.
From the other room.
I can imagine just like hiding, picking up the other phone and like listening in, hiding in the corner. What are they saying about me?
That motherfucker. So unknowingly to Stanley, Barker, he'd been listening to the conversation from the other room. Once again, he flew into a wild rage, just seeing red at this point. This time, Barker picked up a hammer and stormed into the room, telling Stanley to get off the phone. But before he could answer, he whacked him on the back of the head, which sent Stanley to the ground. But, you know, for good measure, Barker managed to get another 8 to 10 more hits of the hammer in before one of the shop employees just literally had to pull him off.
He's got to whack him, he's got to whack him, he's got to whack him again.
So Stanley's head and face were just covered in blood. His white shirt was soaked through red, but he was still alive. In fact, it was Stanley himself that dialed 911, asking for an ambulance and also the sheriff's department, as he wanted to report an assault. Rightly so.
Yeah.
He's got whacked with a hammer.
His brains are hanging out, probably.
Now, in a remarkable piece of police work by the sheriff's deputies, they showed up, assessed the scene, and decided it was best to arrest both men. Charged them both with a misdemeanor assault and put them both in the same cell in the same county jail. Remembering, one of these men just attempted to kill the other one and now they were locked up in the same cell together.
We're not letting you out of here until you guys make up.
You guys figure this out.
Yeah, exactly. You can come out when you're friends again.
Come out. Oh, he's dead. So both men were released from jail later that night, and it was safe to say that the partnership was well and truly over. 2 days later, they met with a lawyer to divide up the business. However, unknowingly to Stanley, Barker had set up a new company and had already started to transfer assets over, including the rocket belt. He had removed it from the Car Audio Plus store, so Stanley had no idea where it was. Understandably, Stanley, he was furious. Having sunk hundreds and thousands of dollars into the rocket belt, he wanted to make his money back. And to do that, he needed the RB2000. He'd no idea where his precious rocket belt was, but he was going to stop at nothing to get it back.
And that's kind of, this is a big crux of the story, is trying to find where the rocket belt was. And is? Question mark?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
So with Larry Stanley temporarily out of the way, Brad Barker and Joe Wright continue to go ahead and test the rocket belt with Bill Suter. This brings us right back to where we left off at the very beginning of our story, when Suter took that first successful untethered flight on a sunny Sunday in Texas, January 1995. With step one of building the rocket complete, they could now move on to step two. Ding, 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 cash register sound, making money. The RB2000's first public flight took place at the Houston Ship Canal in June 1995 at a media party. The party was thrown in honor of the Houston Rockets basketball team, who had just won the NBA championship. A rocket belt to celebrate the Rockets. Hey, listen, that's what we call symmetry over here. The demonstration, which was televised, was a complete success, and Brad Barker and Joe Wright were paid $10,000, to which they paid Bill Suter $2,500 for flying the rocket belt. However, even after the successful demonstration, Bill Suter decided to call it quits, and he retired from being a rocket man for good. Apparently, the ongoing tensions and conflicts between Barker, Wright, and Stanley, just not worth the headache or the money. Bill Suter definitely made the right decision, seeing the crazy people the rocket belt was attracting, and he was like, I'm good. I'm out.
Absolutely. Like, imagine what that was like, showing up that day for the test flight and be like, hey, where's Stanley? He's like, don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about it. He's hammered.
Nice.
In the months that followed, Larry Stanley continued to search for the RB2000, which had not resurfaced since that Houston demonstration. In fact, this was the last time anyone ever saw the rocket belts. I'm wondering, like, Stanley probably had, like, private detectives following Barker around, like searching for it, like looking in every little place he could to try and find this rocket belt. Larry Stanley chased Brad Barker through the courts for 2 years regarding the ownership of the rocket belt with little success. A number of pre-trial depositions were set up, but kept getting delayed as Barker was a no-show several times. He was just not interested in dealing with Larry at all. While all this was going down, Joe Wright's car stereo shop went belly up, and he had to file for bankruptcy, hitting some seriously tough times. Barker and Wright also had a falling out, as everybody around Barker ends up hating him. He just fucks everybody over.
Yeah.
Now, it's not crystal clear why they had a falling out, but considering Barker's history of losing friends, I'd take a wild guess and say it was probably Barker's fault. It didn't help that Wright lost around $10,000 on the Orbi 2000 project either. Joe Wright's bad luck turned into the opportunity Stanley was waiting for. Larry Stanley got in touch with Joe Wright and thought, you know what, let's team up and sue Brad Barker to get back some of our money. So they launched a joint lawsuit against Barker. The problem was that when the lawsuit finally hit in 1999, there was only one person left to testify.
Ooh, and this is where the kind of story goes from being like lighthearted and funny to, it was actually quite serious.
Yeah, this is when shit gets real. So just 11 days before the trial kicked off, someone showed up at Joe Wright's place. They knocked on the door, and when he opened it, they attacked him with a blunt object, beating him so severely that the head and torso were completely destroyed, and he was described as, quote, unrecognizable as a man or woman from the waist up. They were only able to identify the body through dental records 2 days later. Even though the murder was extremely violent and rage-filled, the killer did take the time to clean up the crime scene, removing all traces of them being there. Then, taking a leaf out of the Wet Bandits playbook, they turned on the taps and left the house. When the body was discovered, the running water had partially flooded the crime scene, which further ruined any evidence forensic had hoped to get at. The murder weapon was also never found, but forensics reckoned that a baseball bat was what had been used on poor Joe Wright. Now, Brad Barker was the prime suspect, and he did have motive to kill Joe Wright. The pair had fallen out, they were not on speaking terms, Joe Wright had lost $100,000 on this rocket belt venture, and Joe Wright was now planning on helping Brad Barker's mortal nemesis Larry Stanley get the rocket belt back. Although the police arrested and questioned him about Wright's murder, they lacked enough evidence to keep him in custody. And after 3 days, Barker was set free, disappearing along with the Orb B2000. Larry Stanley was now naturally fearing for his life now that his partner had been beaten to death in his own home. He believed Brad Barker may come after him, so he filed a restraining order and bought himself a .40 caliber Desert Eagle for protection.
Smart move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get the biggest gun you can.
There's a funny story about that gun. So he showed the gun to Nancy Wright when she'd visited to discuss her brother's murder.
Oh, okay, Joe's sister.
Joe's sister, sorry. So as he was showing her the gun accidentally discharged and the bullet whizzed by her head, almost killing her.
Look how cool my gun is. Click, click, click.
You can open a can with it. So Barker wasn't the only suspect in the murder. Police had suspected a bookmaker named Mike Bowman, who Wright borrowed money from when his business went under. Bowman, he'd loaned Wright $30,000, and in return, Wright signed over his $50,000 life insurance policy to Bowman.
Uh-huh, yeah, so that would make sense why he might be a suspect.
Absolutely.
He's going to get 20, he's going to make a profit on your debt.
That's it. So the life insurance, it did raise some red flags with the police, but the sheriff's department had Bowman take a lie detector test, which he passed, so they let him go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Even though lie detectors are like inadmissible in a lot of states and they're proven to be complete bullshit.
Yep.
Literally the only use I ever see lie detectors are, because obviously they come up a lot in cases, is intimidation.
That's
tactic.
They literally
are just used to intimidate suspects into hoping that they'll talk.
This is like one of the first times I've actually seen it being used and like pass and go, oh, okay, and then let them
off.
Yeah. Also, by the way, if anyone's curious, the policy was paid out in full.
Cha-ching. Man, it's a tough one. Who profited more from Joe Wright's death? Brad Barker, who he was suing, or Mike Bowman, who just made $20,000 after lending him $30,000?
That's it. Yeah.
All right.
So there was another suspect as well, Wayne Johnson, a small-time drug dealer who sold Wright crystal meth when he fell on some hard times, but no hard evidence was ever found for that. One thing was for sure, though, whoever did kill Wright was filled with rage. This brutal manner of murder, along with multiple trauma wounds inflicted after death, is what investigators called overkill. So this type of violence is almost never associated with random killings. Instead, it is associated with a personal killing and so-called crime of passion. So,
it definitely seems like someone with a particular grudge against Joe Wright. Maybe someone he was suing.
Someone who flies off the handle at any moment.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who burns all their bridges with every person they've worked with ever. So in July of 1999, Larry Stanley's civil suit finally came to trial. Since the suit had been filed in 1995, the trial had been delayed a number of times by certain parties, namely Barker, failing to show up to depositions. And also, let it be mentioned, the friggin' murder of Joe Wright in 1998. So Stanley would now finally get his chance to face down Barker and get a fair shot at getting what was his, or what he believed was his, or at least half of his. Except, neither Barker nor the Orbi 2000 showed up for the trial. The judge, sick of the delay tactics at this stage, decided to go ahead with the trial, with none of the defendants present. The trial only lasted a day and a half, as there was no defendants, no defense attorneys, no nothing, and so with a strong case put forward by Larry Stanley's attorneys, the judge ruled in Stanley's favor. According to a 1999 article about the lawsuit, quote, "Fed up with years of stalling, a judge Tuesday granted an aviation enthusiast the rights to a one-man rocket belt, awarded him more than $10 million in damages, and ordered the belt returned to him. I'm relieved this is over with," Stanley said after the ruling, but it wasn't quite over just yet.
Cool.
Yeah. Stanley had won the ownership of the rocket belt. Legally, it was his. But no one knew where it was. A year later, with Barker refusing to pay up and remaining completely tight-lipped about the Orbi 2000's whereabouts, Larry Stanley took matters into his own hands, tempting Barker out of hiding with the false promise of a Hollywood film job. Stanley arranged for four men to kidnap Brad Barker.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, as far as this, like, the stupidest shit ever. Barker believed he was helping to film a controlled airliner crash in a desert near LA. However, when he met the men he was supposed to be working with in a North Hollywood home, they pulled an iron on him and told him to get on the ground. At first, Barker thought this was a joke, but when one of the men put him in a chokehold and started to get violent, he realized this was no laughing matter.
This isn't funny.
They bound Barker's arms and legs using a rope and interrogated him for several hours, demanding information on the rocket belt's whereabouts. And also, they were trying to force a confession regarding the killing, the brutal murder of Joe Wright. But Barker, impressively, was not saying a single word about anything. They forced him into a small white wooden box. The lid was drilled shut, and Barker would remain inside that small wooden box for seven entire days. Each day, he was quizzed on the location of the Orbi 2000, but Barker said nothing. He figured the men were going to kill him anyway, so the only thing keeping him alive was the fact that they needed information from him. It's pretty impressive that he didn't speak.
It is impressive. I think he's also extremely stubborn.
Yeah.
Which helps, so.
Yeah, he's a psychopath. So after days of this torment, his nightmare was only getting started. The men began drilling holes in the side of the box. Barker could hear the men talking. One man asked, "Is that enough holes?" To which the other replied, "No. The more holes, the faster it'll sink." With the realization that the men were planning on dumping him in the ocean, Barker began to weep and plead with his captors, but there was no response.
That would be Darvin.
Yeah. After 6 days, Barker was pulled out of the box and dragged into the kitchen. Once his eyes adjusted to the light, he noticed a familiar face. It was Larry Stanley. Barker was told that a notary was coming by to get him to sign some papers waiving his claim to the rocket belt. And if he made any attempt to talk to the notary, they would blow his head off. But hadn't the judge already awarded Larry all the rights to the rocket belt anyway?
They did, but Barker, the way he kind of figured was, he didn't agree with the ruling.
Okay.
He said that he wasn't aware that the case was going on. I think like there was letters being sent out to the wrong address that he, because he was given wrong addresses all the time.
He was giving him wrong address on purpose.
Yeah, so it was being sent to the wrong address. He was like, I wasn't aware it was going on. So he just didn't agree with, you can't make a ruling on something when I wasn't there to defend myself. And like, we've given you every opportunity to show up.
Yeah, it's gone on for like literally 5 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he was just like, no, I don't agree with it.
So he's appealing the ruling and shit.
Yeah, and then he was like, and then it was also like, well, like, where is the rocket belt?
Yeah.
You know? So
it's
like,
amazing.
Yeah.
This story is so fucking wild. Yeah. This story is whack as shit. So, literally with a gun to his head, after signing the papers, Barker was handcuffed and forcefully placed back into the box.
How did the notary not, like, pick up on that?
Yeah, I know. I mean, imagine what they didn't literally have a gun to his head in front of notary, but notary's probably just paid off. Yeah. Larry Stanley was rich, where he was like, he didn't see it.
Yeah, like, oh, okay. It's like, I've got it paid enough for this shit.
Yeah, exactly. So over the next few days, the men kept persisting in interrogating Brad Barker about the rocket belt's location, and he still would not say. However, on the eighth day, Barker successfully wriggled his hands out of the handcuffs and untied his legs. Seizing the opportunity, he forced the box lid open, crawled out, and, once free, escaped the building through a small window. He sprinted for 2 miles through the streets of North Hollywood until reaching a payphone where he called the authorities. When the police picked him up, he was 23 pounds lighter with cuts on his wrists that went down almost to the bone. Stanley faced charges of kidnapping for ransom, false imprisonment via violence, and extortion. The sentencing hearing didn't take place until November 22nd, 2002, and Stanley ultimately received a life sentence plus 10 years, although this was later reduced to 8 years. The thing about this story is at the end of the day, Brad Barker always has the last laugh.
Yes, yeah. He's such an asshole. He got away with everything.
Yeah. Upon hearing the sentence, Larry Stanley said, with tears in his eyes, quote, "My search for the rocket belt has cost me more than $500,000 and left my family destitute and on food stamps." Joe Wright's murder still remains unsolved to this day. Larry Stanley is still in prison to this day, and the Orbe 2000 has never been located. In 2002, when questioned about the rocket belt's whereabouts and whether it would ever resurface, Brad Barker simply replied, "You just never know." The end.
Question mark?
The question. I know. This story is so wild. But I tried to find out stuff on Brad Barker. Nothing.
He's kind of just disappeared.
Disappeared. You did all the research for the story, but I was really curious about, like, what's Brad Barker up to today?
Yeah.
There's not even a load of articles. There's a few long form articles of the story, but it's not that widely known.
Yep.
And no story. That's literally how every story ends.
That's it. Yeah.
Is like, that's the last time anybody has ever heard from Barker is 2002. Yeah, when he was questioned about it. Since 2002, nobody knows where he is or what happened to him.
Yeah.
Or, well, I mean, not publicly anyway. Mm. Not like he's not in the media or anything like that. Nothing I could find.
Yeah.
The closest thing I could find was a question is that I think it's LAX in the airport in Los Angeles where a jetpack has been sighted numerous times.
No way.
Closing down the airport, flying in the area. But and at first people were thinking, oh, is this the return of Brad Barker?
Yeah.
Turns out, though, it probably is it's a drone with an attachment that looks like a person on it. So it looks like a person flying a jetpack, but it's just like a cheap drone.
Right. So it's like a mannequin or something.
Yeah, it's just a mannequin attached to a drone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is kind of lame. And that's the story of the rocket murder. Brad Barker, Larry Stanley, Joe Wright. And as I said, Brad Barker has the last laugh.
Absolutely, yeah.
For a big fucking asshole. You gotta kind of like him, though. At the same time. It's like, it's pretty impressive.
There's a part that you gotta admire, but it's...
He's like such a dick. That's like amazing. Where's the... It's like, they put all this money into the rocket belt. Nobody made any money out of this.
They made that $10,000 at the rocket ceremony. But
after sinking hundreds of thousands of dollars into building the thing.
And then after that, nothing.
I wonder how much money Brad Barker put into it. Because Joe Wright put in a lot and Larry Stanley put in a lot. Like, did Brad Barker put in any of his own money into this
thing? I don't think he put too much in. I'm pretty, like, it was
pretty
mostly... I think it was, like, mostly funded by Stanley. Because, like, his family had, like, the oil fields and stuff. So
yeah.
He had money to burn. Like, we know by the end of it, his family was basically left kind of destitute, but
yeah,
he definitely had a huge chunk of change to kind of start the whole operation. But yeah, I don't think he had too much of his own in, so
yeah,
he kind of just got away with it.
Yeah, man, it's wild.
Yeah,
it's a great story.
It's it's nuts. Yeah. It's a great story. Yeah, it's all over the place, but it's brilliant.
Yeah. All right, I think that'll wrap up this whole episode of the That Chapter podcast. Thanks so much, folks, for listening to the Jetpack Murder and the story of the Rocket Belt, the Orbi 2000.
Mm-hmm.
All right, final closing words, Keith, for this episode of the podcast?
Just if you ever come across a man called Brad Barker who wants to befriend you, run away.
Yes, I couldn't have said it better myself. Once again, Keith, you've taken the words out of my mouth. Yeah, that, and just, you know, if you want to invent a jetpack, go for it. Just, yeah, be careful.
Have fun with it.
Yeah, have fun with it. Beat somebody to death with a baseball bat. Why not? Go for it. All right. Thanks for listening, guys. See you.
See ya. So what we do know for a fact is that Wendell Moore and his team at Bell Aerosmith
Aerosmith. Don't want to miss the... Yeah. Wait, no, is that not a Bon Jovi? No. I always get Aerosmith and Bon Jovi mixed up. That's the second time I've fucking done that on this podcast.
We can get like a diagram on the
wall. I know, yeah.
Don't want to close. No, wait.
Oh, that's good.